A Cuban-American journalist pulls ancestral answers out of a deadly hurricane. Bilingual Miami gets a bilingual poet. But are we now living in a post-literate world? Welcome to a special Miami Book Fair edition of the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll talk with the award-winning Miami journalist Mirta Ojito about her debut novel, Deeper Than the Ocean, and the immigration mysteries it solves. I'll also be joined by Oscar Fuentes, the Biscayne poet, and hear his odes to Miami in English and Spanish with a little music. And Miami Book Fair co-founder Mitch Kaplan will discuss why reading, against all odds, still has a future. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, benvindo. It is Miami Book Fair Week, that time of the year when we say we apparently didn't get the memo that we're living in a post-literate society. So our downtown streets are teeming right now with stalls selling tomes instead of phones. People from all over the world are here holding multilingual discussions about what's read on the printed page instead of what's heard from a podcast influencer. Archaic, you say? No, it's vital. So, we're devoting this week's show to the Miami Book Fair, specifically to local authors. Later on, I'll speak to Oscar Fuentes, a bilingual bard known as the Biscayne poet. After that, I'll talk with Miami Book Fair co-founder Mitch Kaplan about how we overcome that post-literate world that's upon us. But first up is Pulitzer Prize-winning Cuban-American journalist and author Mirta Ojito. She's written a page-turning debut novel of genealogical and meteorological mystery. It's called Deeper Than the Ocean, and it also manages to say a lot of important things about the immigrant experience. And please consider this a sort of on-air book fair presentation. If you have questions or comments to share, call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Mirta Ojito, thank you so much for coming in to talk with us.
Thank you for having me.
And congratulations. Deeper Than the Ocean is a really engaging novel. You've written nonfiction books, one of them a memoir of your family's exodus from Cuba in the 1980 Mariel boat lift. You were partly raised in Miami. You started your career with the Miami Herald, then you went to work for the New York Times, and today you're at NBC Telemundo. But as a journalist, what made you want to take the leap into fiction? How hard is that to do?
Well, Tim, as you know, writing is always difficult.
Yes.
And writing a novel, probably more so, because I was out of my comfort zone.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it was incredibly joyful and liberating to not be a slave to facts and making things up.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, oh, so this doesn't work, I'll change it. Sounds
like fun.
It sounds like fun, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was very faithful to the historical record. Mm-hmm. But other than that, it is very much a product of my imagination.
Now, Deeper Than the Ocean is a compelling family mystery, but that makes my job a bit difficult here.
Yes.
Because there are major league spoilers I don't want to give away. Let me just quickly summarize things as carefully as I can for our listeners. Your story is actually two stories that take place a century apart. The first involves Catalina Quintana, a young woman in Spain's Canary Islands, who is forced into a marriage that will take her to Cuba on a ship that sinks in a hurricane off Key West in 1919. That storm and shipwreck, by the way, actually happened. The second story involves her great-granddaughter, Mara Denise, a Cuban exile journalist from Miami, like you, working in Spain. In 2019, Mara goes to the Canary Islands on assignment, but ends up engrossed in solving the mystery of what actually happened to Catalina, her great-grandmother, a century earlier, and what it reveals not just about Mara's family, but the meaning of being an immigrant. Mirta, why and how did this story come to you?
And when? Because if you can believe it, it was in 2006.
Ah.
Yeah.
So it gestated for more than a decade.
Yes, yeah. Certainly, almost 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So I was in Key West promoting my first book, my memoir, Finding Mañana. And I found, outside a shop, I found a book, a coffee table book with, it was, the title was in Spanish, El Misterio del Valvanera, which is the name of the ship,
right.
The Mystery of Valvanera. And it was only $10, and it caught my eye, and I thought, what is this? What's a Valvanera? I didn't know. And so I took it to the hotel, I read the book, and I realized that this was the Titanic that no one had ever heard of. It was, in fact, it is known as a poor man's Titanic.
Yeah.
You know, the story of this ship coming from Spain, carrying immigrants. It left Spain with almost 1,200 people. Fortunately, it stopped in Puerto Rico and Santiago de Cuba, and some people
got off.
Mm-hmm. But on its way to Havana, a devastating hurricane developed, and sadly, almost 500 people perished. And I thought, I have to tell the story.
And you were able then to build around that factual story, a fictional story that involves how much of your family is involved.
Well, do you know, part of the reason...
Historically in this.
This actually ties to your first question, too, because part of the reason that this is fiction and not nonfiction, which is what I'm used to, is because several reasons. But one of them is that authors such as the one who had written that book I found had already dealt with this extensively.
Right.
The other reason is that after I read that book, I had what I can only describe as a vision. I saw a woman in a lilac dress running through the hallways of a ship with no shoes on and red, curly, flowing hair. And she was desperately looking for her infant daughter. And I thought, okay, that was strange. And who is this woman? And I need to tell her story. And so it began, in my mind, it began to form very quickly as a novel. And I had never done it. And I thought, do you know, maybe I could. Maybe I should give it a try.
A novel that involves a story that could theoretically involve your own family, your own ancestry.
It does in many ways. But I didn't know that then, Tim.
Right. Interesting. Wow. The central event of your novel, as we just pointed out, is the hurricane of 1919 and the ship that sank in it, the Valvanera, which are all real history. No one survived that shipwreck, although some of it, like a mast, still exists out on those shallows off Key West, right?
Yes, absolutely.
So remind us how traumatic that tragedy was for people both in the Canary Islands and Cuba, this poor man's Titanic, as you put it, and why it still resonates today.
Well, it was a very important story at the time. It was on the front page of the Miami Herald, the New York Times, the Times-Picayune. In the robust media in Cuba, everybody covered it. AP carried the story all over the United States and all over the world. It was very serious for Cuba and Spain in particular because these were relatives, right? This was family members who were coming to have a better life, not only in Cuba, but also in Puerto Rico. And this ship, the Valvanera specifically, but others, normally did this all the time. They transported immigrants. It was almost like a maritime bus from Spain to the Americas. And when I say the Americas, I really mean the Americas because it included the United States, like Texas and New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
And so to have something like this happen, it was incredibly tragic. I think it still continues to resonate today, because we're still doing the same thing.
Yeah.
The yearning for a better life hasn't changed. We see it constantly with rafters in Miami, be it from Cuba or from Haiti.
Boat people from Haiti,
absolutely.
Right,
What has changed, perhaps, is the patterns and the journeys from one way to another. And one example is that now the grandchildren and the great-grandchildren of those people who left Spain for the Americas for a better life, many of them are going back to Spain for the same reason.
Right, because of like the Ley de Nietos, the grandchildren's law in Spain that's allowing so many Cubans and others,
Venezuelans,
get citizenship in Spain. Again, I don't want to give away this story's dramatic revelation, so let me just ask, what do you feel and what do you hope we will feel are the most important takeaways from this story? Not just what happens to Catalina and her great-granddaughter Mara a century later, but what these women have to tell us about the key themes you bring up in the novel, among them immigration, feminism, family roots, and fear of the ocean, as it turns out.
Yeah, well, I'm very afraid of the ocean, so I gave that character, the journalist, my fear of the ocean, among other things. But you know, the title of the book refers to many things. Deeper Than the Ocean has to do with the position in which the ship can still be found. By the way, a local reporter recently went and found it, and has Kerry Sanders did. He has amazing video and photos of the Valvanera, still 43 miles away from Key West. But more than that, it also has to do with the unbreakable bonds of family, of those ties that are deeper than the ocean that keeps us together across centuries, across generations, and even across continents. And I really wanted to refer that because I think that's important. And it also has to do, although I didn't intentionally do that, but I think in the end, it's a lot about how hard women's lives were in the first half of the 20th century, and frankly, even today, in many parts of the world, including our own country. But I wanted to recognize that and honor that, because a lot of the stories in the book are about my mother and my grandmother. So that, it was a way of acknowledging that.
Now, immigration, not surprisingly, has been a focus of your journalism career. In the novel, in fact, you call it the world's oldest story. Undoubtedly, it's a major theme in Deeper Than the Ocean, and it's obviously a timely one given the immigration convulsions we're living through this year. You describe its tragedies and triumphs pretty richly in this book, and poignantly. I wanted to ask you to read a passage where the correspondent, Mara, your main character, looks upon the corpse of a young African migrant girl and notices how well-dressed she was.
Yes. I, too, had wondered about the little girl's clothes. But the truth was, I understood why she was wearing ruffles for her trip in a rickety old boat. My fingers hovered over the phone, but I didn't reply. When I was 15, I wore my best clothes to leave Cuba. I didn't wear them to hop in a boat and spend endless hours at sea. I wore them to arrive in the United States. The clothes are aspirational, you see, I wanted to tell Nina. It's not about what you leave behind, but where you're hoping to arrive. It is about the dream, only in this case, the family's dream had died in the ocean.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN, a special Miami Book Fair edition of the South Florida Roundup. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Cuban-American journalist and author Mirtha Ojito about her new novel, Deeper Than the Ocean. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Mirtha, your novel also conveys interesting reflections about not just the immigrant experience, but the islander experience as well, which I think resonates with a lot of our community here, especially Cubans. At one point, Mara, your character Mara, says, quote, "We are, in fact, islanders who live with our backs to the sea," speaking of Cubans. What does she and you mean by that?
That's interesting. That comes from this part of the book. I'm just going to read a sentence. Cubans sit on the famed seawall of Havana, not looking out to the water, but facing the city in its entire crumbling splendor. I've often wondered if that's because of a fear of the sea or a longing for it.
Right, and that seawall is known as the Malecón.
El Malecón. I mean, I think it's really complicated to live in an island such as Cuba, because the sea is both what entraps you and also what makes it possible for you to leave. So we have a complicated relationship with the sea.
No, that was a really interesting reflection you made there. And speaking of islands, one of the other highlights of your novel is how much the reader learns about the Canary Islands, which I think matters a lot, especially here, because so much of our immigrant community has roots in those Spanish islands. Not just Cubans, but Venezuelans like my wife, whose ancestors on her father's side came from Las Canarias. What struck you most as you set about discovering those islands and their history yourself?
Do you know, I had never been to the Canary Islands as I was writing the book. In fact, I finished the book and I hadn't been there. I was superstitious and I thought, I'm not going to do it until I finish. I'm not going to do it until I sell it. And finally, in January of this year, I had to go.
Does your own Cuban family have roots in the Canary Islands?
Yes, but I didn't know that.
Okay.
I learned that later. I'm doing sort of what my character does, what Mara does in the book, I hadn't done when I was writing the book. And now I'm inspired by the own character I created. Mm-hmm. I have since found out that my mother's maternal grandfather was born in the Canary Islands, Antonio Quintana. But what struck me the most was the accent, which actually to my ear, it was more Venezuelan than Cuban.
Interesting.
The food, the same foods that I ate in Cuba that I always thought were Cuban are actually from there. Uh-huh. And words, we use the same words for a lot of things. For example, guagua, for bus. I always thought that was a Cuban word.
Yeah.
It's a Canarian word.
No me digas. Really?
Te lo digo. That's the way it is. Yes, the way it is.
I've been covering Cuba for more than 30 years,
right?
And I didn't know that. Yeah.
I did not know that either.
Oh, wow.
So that was really interesting.
Mm-hmm. I also have to point out that Deeper Than the Ocean is also, perhaps most importantly, a love story or a story of thwarted love. The novel's title, in fact, comes directly from a romantic utterance between Catalina and her lover, Juan. And it's a story we've seen in various forms in a lot of Latin American literature, like, say, the Mexican novel Como Agua para Chocolate, or Like Water for Chocolate. It's also a narrative that plays a large role in Latin American feminism. So did you find yourself drawing on that tradition of Latin American women's literature as you wrote Deeper Than the Ocean?
Or Shakespeare, for that matter,
uh-huh.
with Romeo and Juliet.
Uh-huh.
So
right. Yeah.
It's a long tradition. Look, love is at the center of many, many stories that I have read all my life, not only from Latin America. I didn't do it consciously, but the love story that I really wanted to highlight in the book was really the love story between mothers and daughters.
Mm-hmm.
Not only because I wanted to explore my own relationship with my mother, but also because I wanted to explore her relationship with her own mother, who died, Catalina. She was named Catalina Quintana. And she died young at 40, the day after my mother turned 16.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the central event of my mother's life. It colored everything about her life and about my relationship with her. And so that love story, mothers and daughters, through generations, five generations of women in this book, it's really what I set out to explore.
Finally, Mirta, I want to end here with another important reflection the Cuban exile Mara, the character, makes in the novel about going back to Cuba for the first time, which is something many, many Cuban Americans here experience, and which she calls, quote, the curse of exiles, to return to the forbidden place, to be always searching for that elusive home. You quote in the novel a Syrian exile writer who asks, what do you do when you can't stay and you can't go back? Is Deeper Than the Ocean in that sense not just a family mystery tale, but a means of reconciling for you that emotional struggle as a Cuban?
Frankly, Tim, when you can't stay and you can't go back, you write a novel, as I just did.
Good point.
Yes. I have no other answer. I don't think I was really reconciling anything. The wound of departure never really leaves you. The wound of exile, you adapt, you become a different person, but you leave who you were behind. And that reconciliation doesn't really happen with a book. It doesn't really, for me, it doesn't really happen with anything, but it helps somehow to put it in perspective and to be able to encapsulate all of those feelings in a book such as Deeper Than the Ocean.
Well, congratulations again.
Thank you so much.
It's a fascinating debut novel. Mirta Ojito's debut novel is Deeper Than the Ocean. She'll discuss the book tomorrow at 11 a.m. at Miami-Dade College's downtown Building 8. Mirta, again, many thanks.
Thank you.
Still to come, Miami's bilingual bard, Oscar Fuentes, the Biscayne poet, and his new volume of verse, Poetry City, Ciudad Poesía. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the special Miami Book Fair edition of the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Miami, and much of South Florida for that matter, is not just a bilingual community, but a trilingual one as well when you factor in Haitian Creole, even quadrilingual if we count all the Brazilian Portuguese spoken here. Still, English and Spanish predominate, so it's cool, or chévere, or padre, or however you want to say it in Espanol, when an author, especially a poet, speaks to us here in both idioms. Enter Oscar Fuentes, also known as the Biscayne Poet. Oscar was born in New York to Honduran immigrant parents, but he's adopted Miami, and his bilingual verse about the city and its rich human tapestry is some of the most popular in the 305 today. Fuentes' new volume of poetry has, of course, a bilingual title, Poetry City, Ciudad Poesía. And it takes us everywhere, from Biscayne Bay to Alapata, from Little Havana to Shark Valley, from Overtown to Homestead. And in each poem, Fuentes locates the soul of those corners of our community in Spanish and English, which is no small feat. Have you read Oscar Fuentes' poetry? What are your thoughts on our bilingual culture? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now in the studio is Oscar Fuentes. Qué macizo es tenerte a ti con nosotros. It is great to have you here with us. Thanks for coming in, Oscar.
Thank you for having me.
I should mention we're also joined by Oscar's musical accompanist, Vincent DuPont, who will grace us with strains of the upright bass as Oscar reads his poetry. So, Oscar, did I use the right Honduran expression there?
Yes, you did.
It's been a decade since I last reported in Honduras, and Que Macizo is one I do remember. As I mentioned, like most Miamians, you're from somewhere else, as am I, in your case, New York. But you brought the Latino sensibility here with you, and in particular, that bilingual sensibility that's so prominent here. What drew you to Miami, and why did you obviously fall in love with the place as a poet?
Well, my parents brought me here as a child, so I had no say in coming to Miami.
Okay.
I've been here since I was a kid.
All right.
And I fell in love with the city just growing up in it, you know, unfolding, becoming a young man and becoming a dad.
What part of Miami did you grow up in?
Off of Coral Way and 32nd Terrace.
Okay. Uh-huh.
So near the Grove, we went to the Gumbe Festival many times
right.
with my dad. And so I fell in love with the city, with Biscayne Bay, with going over the Rickenbacker Causeway,
mm-hmm.
you know, seeing the surrounded islands by Christo and Jean-Claude back in the 80s. I mean, I was inspired by this city and what it was doing.
Why also was it so important for you to present your poetry in both Spanish and English? As I mentioned before, I can speak from experience that translation is not an easy task, but you've made a point of taking it on as a poet. Why?
Well, it's my responsibility as a Hispanic, you know, writer to write in Spanish. You know, also, I owe it to my parents. My parents want to read my work, and that's one thing my mom asked me, please, write something I can read, you
right.
know? So this
right.
is
okay.
this is for my mom and my parents and for everyone else that English doesn't come easy to them, you know? So
yep.
this is a way to
make and we forget that English is one of the hardest languages in the world to learn. I mean, it's because it makes no sense.
Yes.
I mean, Spanish makes sense. English does not.
Yeah. So, you know, now my family in Honduras mm-hmm. are enjoying my work in Spanish also.
So let's dive into some of your bilingual verses about Miami from your new book, Poetry City, Ciudad Poesía. And let's start with one called America. Now, just quickly, Oscar, tell our listeners what this one is about and what it conveys.
America is about, it's my experience of the everyday here in Miami.
Mm-hmm.
The everyday, my going to lunch at the local Honduran restaurant, sitting in traffic, seeing people drive the same direction that I drive. Seeing the construction workers up in that building, the fruit vendor in the corner. America is the people I see every day here in Miami.
So let's read an excerpt from it. You read the stanzas in Spanish, I'll read them in English, and we'll be accompanied by Vincent DuPont on bass.
America, ¿dónde estás? ¿Estás en el cafecito de la ventanita en Little Havana? ¿En los frondosos campos de los Everglades? ¿O en los callejones de los barrios del centro de la ciudad?
America, where are you? Are you in the cafecito at La Ventanita in Little Havana? The lush fields of the Everglades or the alleyways of inner city neighborhoods?
¿Estás en el embotellamiento de cientos buscándote? Preguntándome si estás en nuestras oficinas. En cada destino que encontramos?
Are you in the traffic jam of hundreds searching for you, wondering if you're at our offices, at every destination we find?
¿Eres la nueva política de inmigración que aleja a aquellos que vienen en busca de una vida mejor? ¿Quién cultivará nuestras tierras? ¿Cortará nuestro césped? o trabajará en los restaurantes hondureños haciendo tortillas a mano.
Are you the new immigration policy, sending away those who come searching for a better life? Who will farm our lands, mow our lawns, or work in the Honduran restaurants making handmade tortillas?
¿Quién es América? ¿Tienes miedo de tú misma? ¿Temes ver tu propio reflejo?
Who is America? Are you afraid of yourself? Scared to see your own reflection? Oscar, are you also suggesting there that Miami itself is more and more the reflection of America's face that it now sees in the mirror and is perhaps afraid of seeing in the mirror?
Precisely that. You know, sometimes, you know, I mean, we become this place that we inhabit, you know, and, you know, we can see ourselves in others. I think this empathetic way of existing sharing the same city with others, you know, mm-hmm. makes us see ourselves also in other people's faces.
Yeah. Let's read another one here, which I also really like, a lovely reflection on the South Dade city of Homestead, and it's titled Homestead. Take it away, sir.
Eres la puerta al salvaje, un lugar donde la ciudad se desvanece en campos y bosques.
You are the gateway to the wild, a place where the city fades into fields and forests.
He conducido por tus caminos, pasado por los viveros y los puestos de frutas, y sentido la fuerza de la tierra bajo tu superficie.
I've driven your roads, past the nurseries and farm stands, and felt the pull of the earth beneath your surface.
Eres un lugar de crecimiento, pero me pregunto si alguna vez oyes los ecos de los huracanes que pasan como fantasmas.
You are a place of growth, but I wonder if you ever hear the echoes of the hurricanes that pass through like ghosts.
La tierra recuerda lo que nosotros olvidamos, guardando las cicatrices de cada estación en su suelo.
The land remembers what we forget, holding the scars of every season in its soil.
Tu resiliencia está enraizada en la tierra, una fuerza silenciosa que perdura a través de cada tormenta.
Your resilience is rooted in the earth, a quiet strength that endures through every storm.
Eres un recordatorio de que el crecimiento no siempre es fácil, pero siempre es posible.
You are a reminder that growth is not always easy, but it is always possible.
Me atrae tu espíritu firme, tu conexión inquebrantable con la tierra.
I am drawn to your grounded spirit, your unshakable connection to the land. That's not only a lovely ode to Homestead, Oscar. To me, and I also live in South Dade, it's spot on. Why does a South Florida corner like Homestead affect you this way?
You know, Homestead, for me and for many people, is a nostalgic space here in South Florida. Mm-hmm. You drive there and you see faces that are familiar. They remind me of my friends and my family members in Honduras. And just going over there to buy some fresh fruit or visit a restaurant, mm-hmm. it's like traveling back in time, back to Central America.
You mentioned those homemade tortillas from Honduras. What remind us again the name of those tortillas that are so popular in Honduras?
Well, look, the handmade tortillas, las tortillas de maíz, the ones of corn and the ones de harina.
Right.
Handmade. I mean, you try those and it's like your grandmother is cooking
those
for you.
So that's interesting. We think of Homestead as a new place, but you describe it as a nostalgic place. That's a poet's sensibility.
Well, Homestead has a feeling that is so old that it's new all over again. At the same time, it's extremely antique.
Right. This is a special Miami Book Fair edition of the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with bilingual Miami poet Oscar Fuentes about his new book of verse titled Poetry City, Ciudad Poesía. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. And a reminder that if you miss any part of the program, you can search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Oscar, since bilingualism is such an important facet of your poetry, I also wanted to ask you if you think conveying your verse in both Spanish and English matters even more because of the fear we hear a lot today that while the idea of Spanglish is a charming part of the Miami character, that mixture of the two languages also runs the risk of making future generations here perhaps less proficient in both languages, that we're perhaps raising kids who might not end up speaking either Spanish or English as well as they should. My wife is a bilingual teacher, and I know she shares some of that concern. Do you?
I do too. You know, we have a political Alzheimer's lurking around our dinner table. And there's a lot of distractions in our conversation today, you know? And we're not asking the right questions to our family members, our abuelas. We're not having those conversations with our grandmothers or our grandfathers about important things. And our kids are not being brought up, you know, with this importance of language, mm-hmm. of communicating in our you know, original parent tongue.
Right. Now, you just bring up, you know, different generations. Obviously, a big part of your poetry is focused on the immigrant experience, especially in places like the city we just read about, Homestead. Let's go back there briefly and read part of a poem from Poetry City, Ciudad Poesía, that reflects that. It's called Abajo en Homestead or Down in Homestead. Go ahead.
Abajo en Homestead, Loida y sus 15 compañeros de trabajo se despiertan a las 4 a.m. en un cuarto comunal, vistiéndose a toda prisa para no perder el autobús de la compañía.
Down in Homestead, Loida and her 15 co-workers rise at 4 a.m. in a communal sleeping room, pulling on work clothes in a hurry to catch the company bus.
Otro día más bajo la sombra de la servidumbre moderna, cuidando palmas africanas en una finca manejada por dos hermanos cubanos, Aurelio y Rubén.
Their day begins under the shadow of modern-day servitude, tending to African palm trees on a farm managed by two middle-aged Cuban brothers, Aurelio and Rubén. The poem goes on to describe the uneasy dynamic between those newly arrived migrants in South Florida and the more established, more privileged immigrants. Is that a facet of the immigrant experience here, Oscar, that you feel is perhaps too often ignored?
It was definitely an immigrant experience of mine growing up here and not being a Cuban migrant, but being a Honduran migrant. My wife is Cuban, by the way, and I embrace the Cuban culture. We share the same tradition in a way, you know. So yes, that poem is about falling in love with someone that is different from you, mm-hmm. a different culture, and our differences are there, but we embrace those because mm-hmm. love is powerful than anything else.
Now, you, of course, write about many other parts of the Miami community, from Little Havana to Overtown. And as a poet, what strikes you about the differences and similarities between these varied neighborhoods? How, as a poet, do you try to reconcile how wonderfully disparate Miami can be, but is often tragically fractured as well sometimes?
You know, Miami has a personality. Miami is a character in our own family tree,
yeah.
You know, and just like one of our family members, like ourselves, Miami is not perfect, mm-hmm. you know, and I think it's in that imperfection that really makes us, you know, see ourselves reflected in it, you know, and it's important to have a city that is extremely different in different neighborhoods because it's what it is. It's a song, it's a salsa.
Right, which is not often the case with a lot of American cities, which has become very homogeneous these days. Let's end here, Oscar, with part of another poem from Poetry City, Ciudad Poesía, that we all very much liked here, called Bombástica, or Bombastic. Again, just briefly, tell us what this is about, just briefly.
Well, it's about, you know, the climate crisis that we're going through here, the how it floods regularly in Miami.
Yeah. King tides, okay.
Yeah, right. And also, you know, the... Well, let's read the poem.
Okay, go ahead.
Bajo la hierba verde, el agua salada se filtra. Un recordatorio silencioso del lento acceso del mar. mientras los sueños inmobiliarios de Miami flotan, intactos ante la amenaza inminente.
Underneath the green grass, salt water creeps in, a quiet reminder of the sea's slow rise, while Miami's real estate dreams float on, untouched by the looming threat.
Todo forma parte de un espectáculo brillante, una propuesta bombástica para los snowbirds, perdidos, curiosos y escépticos, vagando por calle 8, sus GPS llevándolos a la ventanita de Versalles, un lugar lleno de personas que aparentemente tienen miedo, pero que secretamente adoran la personalidad del hombre fuerte, algo que nunca entenderé.
It's all part of a flashy show, a bombastic pitch to the snowbirds, lost, curious, or skeptical, wandering Calle Ocho, their GPS leading them to Versailles' Ventanita, a place with people who act afraid but secretly adore the strongman persona, something I'll never understand. Oscar Fuentes' new book of poetry is titled Poetry City, Ciudad Poesía. He'll do a reading on Sunday at 10:30 a.m. for the book fair's off-the-shelf program at 300 Northeast 2nd Avenue in downtown Miami. He was accompanied on the upright bass by Victor DuPont. Oscar, Victor, many thanks. Muchas gracias.
Muchas gracias.
Still to come, a discussion with the Miami Book Fair's co-founder Mitch Kaplan about the future of an endangered species, book reading. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to our special Miami Book Fair edition of the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. A couple months ago, a friend sent me a Substack article from a weekly newsletter called Cultural Capital, and it jolted me. It was a deeply researched piece headlined The Dawn of the Post-Literate Society, and described the imminent death of book reading. One really bad omen? 40 years ago, more than a third of U.S. teenagers read in their leisure time every day. Today, only about a tenth do. Half those teens today say they hardly ever read in their leisure time. 40 years ago, only 15% confessed to that. That should put the importance of events like the Miami Book Fair in bolder relief, because reading isn't just a quaint fashion, it's a human imperative. It's what raised us out of the Middle Ages and into the Renaissance and the Enlightenment. So we invited Miami Book Fair co-founder Mitch Kaplan, who's also founder of Books and Books, to share his valuable insights on whether or not the reading of books still has a future. We'd like to hear your thoughts as well. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. I am honored, as always, now to have join me Mitchell Kaplan. Mitch, many thanks for talking with us.
Tim, it's great to be back with you. It's great to be on WLRN, which has always been a huge supporter of everything literary and the Miami Book Fair in particular, even from the beginning over 40 years ago.
That's great to hear. Let me just start by asking what you find most exciting about this year's edition of the Miami Book Fair. What are some of the things you hope people will take away from it?
Well, I think it flows into what you opened our segment with. I think the exciting thing is to see how many people are coming out for books.
Yeah.
For basically something that is analog. It's something that doesn't rely on all of the digital experience that we are inundated with. And to see the amount of people, the amount of young people, the thrilling discussions that are going on, it kind of tells me that the article that you mentioned, which is an article that I read as well, is a little bit of hyperbole, I think.
Okay, so you feel perhaps the scholars and academics that are warning us every day that the reading of books feels to be going the way of the dodo bird in this century, you feel that's exaggerated, that specter that they're warning us about is exaggerated?
Yeah, I do. Let me tell you why. I've owned a bookstore for over 40, close to 44 years. The book that this article relies on is a favorite book of mine called Amusing Ourselves to Death by Neil Paul. Saltzman.
Right.
But we brought him down to talk about it. But I want to point out that that book was written in the 80s. It was talking about the death of reading then. This is almost 50 years later, and the book has not died. So I think from where I sit, I have basically lived through four or five different times when the book was supposedly on life support. And it's, to me right now, stronger than ever. But, and I am seeing a customer base of young people coming in, which I didn't see 20 years ago. 20 years ago, we would have a joke in the book business that we were following our customers to their graves. Like the last customer would come in, buy a book, walk out of the store, drop dead, and we would have to close our shop.
But you mentioned young people, which that article focuses on, and it quotes professors at elite colleges and universities in this country who say quite candidly that the students they're receiving these days are, as one says, functionally illiterate. One cited the example of students who couldn't get through the opening paragraph of Dickens's novel Bleak House, one of my favorites, without giving up. So how do we reconcile what these experts are telling us, what they're seeing in the university classroom today, with what perhaps you say you're seeing in your bookstores when it comes to young readers?
Well, I think it's hard to generalize from the particular. I am sure that there are some students who can't get through the first paragraph of Bleak House, but they are getting through the writing of Gravity's Rainbow by Thomas
Pynchon. Right.
It's become a kind of cult, a re-energized classic right now, which is a very, very difficult book to read through.
Yeah.
I think what's happening is that we are seeing kids reading differently today. They are not necessarily not reading. What's happening is they are just reading differently. I mean, the article has a very kind of 19th, 20th century bias that they are talking about. Reading is really becoming something different. We're seeing a multicultural writers writing in different ways.
Yeah.
We're seeing writers utilize not necessarily strict narrative, but being, you know, using imagery. Look at the rise of graphic novels, for instance, right?
Yeah.
We have Spiegelman, who wrote Mouse, coming to the Miami Book Fair. Graphic novels are in its ascendancy.
Oh, no. Last year on this book fair show last year, we had a Jamaican author present his graphic history of Jamaican history. So yeah, I agree with you that part. Persepolis, for example, being a prime example of that trend.
So what I would say is that we're not in a post-literate age. We're moving into a multi-literate age. You know, the rise of audiobooks, for instance, right? Audiobooks have become huge.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something the smartphone has allowed people to do, is that they go on walks, they do whatever. Audiobooks are now almost eclipsing the digital book in terms of sales.
Yeah.
You can also talk about the digital book. People, you know, you talk about the smartphone, people are reading on their smartphone, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're reading books on their smartphone. They are buying them that way.
Okay.
People have there are more formats, there's more access. And I would point out, there's also more global voices than ever before. If you look and see, when I first started, you know, it was basically all the white guys who were talking about, whether
like,
it was
like Dickens.
Well, but even before, but even in the 20th century, you had Updike, you had Roth, you had all those guys. Now you have just such a variety of different voices, and the world is opening to them.
Yeah.
And what I'm finding is, because publishers are now publishing to different audiences, those audiences are coming in. So we see a much more multicultural audience for books coming not only to the bookstore, but to the book fair as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I celebrate that.
This is a special Miami Book Fair edition of the South Florida Roundup. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Book Fair co-founder Mitch Kaplan, founder of Books and Books, about the future of reading and if it even has a future, which Mitch definitely seems to think it has. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. I'm glad you brought up the smartphone because I wanted your opinion, too, on this theory that so many experts are always bringing out, that the screen, the internet, and especially the cursed iPhone, that is who they blame as the culprit of this, quote, post-literate society we are entering. Again, do you think they are exaggerating the effect that the iPhone, for example, is having on the erosion of that daily leisure time book reading trend that we're seeing amongst younger Americans?
Well, let's talk about that for a minute. In the article, he talks about misinformation, and people always do in terms of TikTok and others. I want to point out that misinformation existed long before TikTok, right?
Sure.
We had fascism in this in the world. We had the Civil War. There was Jim Crow.
Well, you got Ken Burns' American Revolution documentary going on right now, and misinformation was information at that time in this country.
Exactly. So let's talk about what the smartphone brings us. I think when people talk about the smartphone and screens, they're really talking about social media, right? Mm-hmm. They're really talking about Instagram. They're talking about all, you know, being hooked on all of that. I would argue that as a device itself, it opens up the ability to access reading books. I mean, you can really now access, you know, you just had Oscar on. You can access any poem you want on your smartphone at any given time you want it.
Yeah,
I think that's pretty astonishing.
Yeah.
I keep a list of poems on my smartphone. And if I have a downtime, I just turn to that list and I start reading different poems that I found online and that are now exist on my smartphone.
And you feel kids in their 20s, for example, are doing that sort of thing themselves?
All the time. Look, one of the biggest trends that I'm seeing right now are kids in their 20s who grew up only with the digital world want to turn to the analog. There's been a rise, as you know, in the records. There's been a rise in books. Look at Book Talk, right?
Yeah.
Look what's happening with the trends. We're doing something with Alyssa, who works in our store, of silent readings, where they're reading at bars. She's taking it all over to Zay, to the bookshop, to bars. And young people mostly are getting together and sitting down, grabbing a book, mm-hmm. and reading silently together.
Right.
They want community. They want a sense of community.
Well, Mitch, let's end here. We've got a caller, actually, Eric from Fort Lauderdale, who's got something to add to this conversation. Eric, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. What are your thoughts?
Well, thank you. My daughter is a freshman in high school, and in her entire academic career, she has been assigned one novel to read. Most of her reading education has been essays and things that to me seem very geared towards preparing her for standardized tests. I think there's something to be said for screens being a problem, but there's also something to be said for the fact that I don't think we're very good at teaching reading as something that's to be a pleasure anymore.
Okay. Well, thanks very much, Eric. Mitch, just in 10 seconds, your thoughts on what Eric had to say there?
I think what Eric is saying is absolutely true, and I'm going to bring up one point, and that is a lot of teachers are doing that because they're afraid of book banning.
Good. That's another discussion we'll have to have at another time. I'm sorry, Mitch, we've run out of time. Mitch Kaplan is co-founder of the Miami Book Fair and founder of Books and Books. Mitch, many thanks.
Thank you. Come out to the book fair, everyone.
Finally on the roundup, speaking of local literature, the 2024 Pulitzer finalist play Here There Are Blueberries has returned to Miami, where it was born. Based on a true story, Here There Are Blueberries confronts us with a mysterious Nazi-era photo album that made its way to an archivist at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. It follows the often agonizing journey of curators as they decipher the truth about those images and what they reveal about the perpetrators of the Holocaust. As one character puts it,
"It is very powerful to be able to see what we're not supposed to see. And we were not supposed to see this."
Here There Are Blueberries was co-authored by Miami playwrights Moises Kaufman and Amanda Gronick, and it had its debut at the Miami New Dramas Colony Theater in Miami Beach in 2018. Now, as part of a national tour, the play is being staged there again until December 7th. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Jimena Romero with assistance from Denise Royal. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital director. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news. The vice president of radio and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. MJ Smith engineered today's show. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.
WLRN.